This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, immigration-related issues affecting employment law. Immigration continues to be one of the nation's most divisive controversies, but the new year is expected to bring with it a renewed push for comprehensive immigration reform. There is no shortage of topics to discuss affecting the employment arena, including the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, the DREAM Act, E-Verify, and more. So we'll get right to it with Davis Bay, a Seattle attorney who practices with the nationwide employment law firm of Jackson Lewis.
Davis, immigration has been such a hot-button issue, and President Obama made big news with his administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, as it's more commonly known. Tell us what that is and why it matters for employers.
What DACA is a administrative order that pushed the emphasis on who the Immigration Service will look at in terms of adjudicating deportation cases or removal cases. It provided for work authorization for people who qualify as childhood arrivals. It is in many ways similar to the DREAM Act, which was never actually passed by Congress, but with the election results, the DREAM Act looks much more likely to be passed in the upcoming years. The reason why it's important for employers, however, is that it puts employers at a bit of a quandary. While DACA does allow for individuals who currently have no status to get work authorization, employers have to be very careful on how they manage the messaging. For example, I had an employer who wanted to embrace DACA and alert his employees to notify them if they need assistance. And I had to tell the employer that this is actually the wrong maneuver, even though you may support these individuals. Should you encourage them to come out and explain their immigration status, you may be forced to actually terminate or suspend their status for two reasons. The first is, if they come out and they don't have any work authorization at all, and they tell you that they're going to apply, they're effectively telling you that they have no status currently. And employers, even if they can eventually hire these people, cannot hire individuals where they knowingly have no basis for work authorization. The second problem comes out is if the employer has any form of misrepresentation or honesty provision in their employment policies. And if that comes up, it's very hard for an employer to skirt that particular policy in order to support someone who qualifies for DACA. For example, if someone was to be forgiven for misrepresenting their identity and their social security number and such, how does that employer then separate that case from someone else who have made some other form of misrepresentation and was terminated for that reason?
Davis, are there any special nuances with the program that HR really needs to especially be aware of?
Well, the interesting thing about the program is there's a fairly significant amount of documentation that has to be established to show that the person qualifies, in addition to their good moral character and their issues of their education or being high school educated. There's also the requirement that you show physical presence. So HR maybe asks questions from time to time from individuals who say, can you write a letter showing that I've been employed for a certain period of time and here working for the company? The tricky part of that, however, is that if the employee says, I'm doing this because I want to qualify for DACA, the employer will then again have reasons to know the person doesn't have status in the United States. I guess there's two good things that are coming up with DACA. First of all, there was this impression that there would be this massive flow of cases coming from DACA. And when the original executive order was made, I felt, and a lot of attorneys agreed, that there wouldn't be a flood of cases because it was a situation where the ultimate outcome for these individuals was unknown. In other words, they say that they have no status in the United States. They apply for this relief. And then at some point, if there's a change of administration, the relief would disappear. In this case, however, because of the re-election, we know that the program will continue on. So that concern or that flood of applications originally before the election may actually start to increase because of the re-election of Obama. However, it isn't a path to citizenship. It isn't a path to permanent residence or correcting the individual status. I think a lot of people are going to actually wait to see if DREAM is approved. And if the DREAM Act is approved, it gives them a much more solid ground knowing that moving forward, they will have the ongoing ability to ultimately correct their status in the United States. And there are 12 million people estimated in the United States that don't have authorized status.
Well, let's talk about the DREAM Act for a second there. Do you think that passage is in the cards now that the president's been reelected? And if so, maybe just talk a little bit about what it would do.
Well, the DREAM Act is part of overall comprehensive immigration reform. And for the last 10 years, we've heard multiple presidents talk about comprehensive immigration reform, but there wasn't the impetus or there wasn't the incentive for Congress to pass it. And that's where it always got stuck. George Bush talked about the DREAM Act and comprehensive immigration reform, and it never passed. I think more important than Obama being reelected, it was the clear showing with the demographics for the Republican Party and for other individuals who are against immigration reform to realize that immigration is an essential issue for voters, that the minority voters for whom immigration is particularly important is growing. And we've seen Boehner talk about immigration reform in the day after the election results. We've seen other Republican pundits talk about immigration reform. And it's important to note that it isn't necessarily a Democratic versus Republican issue. The House tends to be more against comprehensive immigration reform than the Senate. So with the strong showing that immigration is an important issue for all these new voters and the growing demographic of minority voters, I think that we're going to see comprehensive immigration reform. And as part of that, the softball in there is the DREAM Act, that specific provision for childhood arrivals.
So this might be one of those rare pieces of legislation that gets through the gridlock in Washington, it sounds like.
With the lame duck Congress, for the senators and the congressmen who are going to be leaving, with the strong desire not to appear to be against immigration reform, I think that we are going to see something. However, we don't know what it's going to look like. There is very strong special interest within immigration. There's the business interest for demographics or for industries that want to see more H-1Bs, for example, and that's a work authorized visa category for professionals. There is motivation for people who are in the process now who want to see a faster process to get to permanent residence. And then, of course, you have all the people who may not have authorized status in the United States who want their interests to be representative. We don't know what immigration reform will look like yet. And I think that what we're going to see is smaller parts of the immigration reform being more clearly passed than others. I think, though, the DREAM Act is an easy one.
Again, we've been speaking with Davis Bay from Jackson Lewis in Seattle. And Davis, I wanted to ask you, because we've been touching on a number of areas here, what do you see as the biggest misconception that employers have in this area?
Oh, there are so many misconceptions about immigration in the United States. One of my favorite things I tell employers is that there are no dumb questions because immigration in the United States can be, at best, an illogical process. We are driven by a very fractured immigration program. What we think is common sense isn't necessarily the way the government works in terms of immigrating to the United States. Other countries have a point system so that depending on education and health, income, all those are calculated into points that allow someone to immigrate into the United States. It may be something they look at more clearly in the immigration reform. What I think the most common misunderstanding when it comes to immigration is that there is some correlation to a logical process and how our immigration system works. I think frequently employers and individuals who look at immigration lose sight of the process on top of whether we want or we have a strong interest in having someone in the United States. What I hear so often is that someone will tell me, that can't be the law. That just doesn't make any sense. This is a good person. This is someone who's going to benefit our economy. This is someone who is married to a U.S. citizen. Why couldn't they immigrate into the United States? And I say that there are roadblocks that we have administratively to file their case. The best example that I can give is that I will have someone who is a child of a U.S. citizen, and it could take years for that individual to come into the United States. But a parent of a U.S. citizen is available immediately. That there are per-country quotas that will take someone from India or China possibly 20 years to immigrate into the United States if current backlogs are still existing. Whereas if the person who is the exact same person happened to be married to someone who is not Chinese or Indian, that person would be able to immigrate almost immediately. So there are all sorts of illogical provisions that have been created because our immigration system has been pieced together for so many decades.
I wanted to talk with you just for a moment about the new form I-9, because I know there's some potential there for increasing fraud and perhaps complexity. So talk a little bit about that, if you will.
Well, the current form I-9 actually expired in August, and it has an extension that was based upon the period of comments that was allowed when the new I-9 form was first presented to the public. And there were so many issues with regard to the proposed form that the government pulled back the form and said, continue to use the old form until the new form has been thoroughly reviewed and these comments have been addressed. I think that they're going to hold off. I hope they hold off on implementing the new form until after the new year so that we could get past all the seasonal hiring that people have to do for the holiday season. The new form is supposed to be an improvement. There are certain problems with the form that still make it unclear for the employer. The current form I-9 is a one-page form with almost 70 pages of instruction. We've made it now a two-page form, and we don't know how many pages of instruction there will be on top of that in terms of the user manual. The new form is supposed to make some elements of where the employer and employee responsibilities are more clear, but there are some problems with the data entries in terms of how the data goes in and also how it's going to mix with electronic systems, which are more common. We just simply don't know how the government intends to execute this form in a way that is any more clear to the employer. If the government is going to continue its policy, which I highly anticipate will actually increase with regard to I-9 compliance, the form has to be simpler. The form has to have better instructions and give an employer a reasonable chance to execute them in a way that's manageable. This is a wonderful time for employers to reinforce training about why compliance is so important, and also a time to step back and take a look at their existing I-9s and really break down the new I-9s for whoever is going to be executing them.
You mentioned that training is especially important. Do you think that enforcement is going to be a big push for that in light of the election results?
We're expecting to see the ICE enforcement campaign on I-9s to increase again year after year. Last year, 2011, we saw about 2,500 I-9 investigations. It started in 2009 and we had 500. So we went up from 500 some odd investigations to 2,500 in 2011. In 2012, it will increase again. And I think in 2013, we may see about 500 new ICE audits every 2 months, somewhere along the lines of 6,000 audits, with employers getting re-audited and larger employers getting audited. And probably the reason why I think employers really need to stop and take a look at their I-9s and look at their compliance programs is the I-9 audit is a trigger for other investigations. If you have misclassification or discrimination that's evident in your I-9s, you may get a call from the Office of Special Counsel, or you may get an investigation from Wage and Hour, from the Department of Labor. There has been at least one case where there was an SEC investigation that started with an ICE investigation. The new form and E-Verify open up the company to data mining, that it just puts out there for, especially E-Verify, it puts out there for the government agency an easy way to slice and dice the data to determine if there are other violations beyond immigration compliance. And I think what employers have to realize is that the I-9 is not about whether you have or have not hired individuals who are immigrants or who do not have status. It is employer compliance for all employees, regardless of whether those people are immigrants or not.
I'm glad you touched on E-Verify. I know we have just a couple of minutes left, and that's certainly an area that I wanted to address with you because that's been such a political football these last couple of years, that federal system for verifying an employee's eligibility to work in the U.S., and we've seen states going well beyond where the federal government is. What do you foresee happening with E-Verify going forward?
There was a very important case that came to the Supreme Court that started in Arizona, and it's not the Arizona immigration law that everyone thinks of. It was a E-Verify rule that allowed the state of Arizona to pull business licenses if individual companies failed to meet their federal immigration requirements. What the Supreme Court said is that it was perfectly reasonable for a state to pull a business license. And actually, this applies down to even the municipality level. So what this means is that an employer could have different E-Verify rules all around the country. And the reason why this is relevant is that it really presses the need for the federal government to pass a national E-Verify rule. E-Verify is required throughout the country at various levels. E-Verify also has provisions that make it required for federal contractors. So the reason why I think E-Verify is relevant is that eventually it is going to be a national requirement. In all my years of practice since E-Verify has been around, I had generally told people, especially in Washington State where I am, that it's not a requirement of the state unless you're a federal contractor. It may not be something that you want to do because it's more than what's required. And now my advice is with employers is it's probably going to be required of everybody. If you have the capacity and you want to get ahead of the rule and you are willing to do E-Verify, then it may be something that you want to implement now. So I think that the short answer is that E-Verify is a reality that has support from both sides of the aisle, and it is something that we're going to see become more relevant around the country, and employers who are willing to undertake it now should probably go ahead and start looking at it.
Interesting. So you think that it might eventually become mandatory even for private employers?
Yes, I think that eventually it will become mandatory. This is my speculation, but I think it's something that's shared by a lot of lawyers.
Well, Davis, I really appreciate your insights. And before we let you go, I wanted to ask if there was any final piece of advice that you had for HR and employers.
Well, it would be to go back and look at your immigration compliance program. When ICE comes through, and I've frequently written articles saying this is the dawn of the ICE age or the ICE man cometh, it's because it's true. ICE is now become a factor in the way that human resources has to look at their I-9 program. It is something that almost every HR person has heard of a story of someone they know or some other company in the area that had got hit with an ICE audit that was very detrimental to the company. If an employer gets ahead of ICE, conducts an internal audit, so much of the liability that ICE could find if the corrections are made after the audit go away. In other words, if you do a self-audit, if you get your compliance program up and make it very strong, you will get much more leverage if you get an ICE investigation.
We'll let that be the last word. Davis Bay from Jackson Lewis in Seattle has been our guest as we discuss the DREAM Act, DACA, and E-Verify and related issues. Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this ExpertHR.com podcast. Thanks again for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on cutting-edge topics, including a panel discussion you won't want to miss about how the 2012 election affects employment law.
The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2012, all rights reserved.